I am Plant on the Line here at thecommentary.ca. How long a walk is it from schoolyard bullying to bust-out genocide? Internationally recognized educational speaker and author Barbara Coloroso has written a new book, Extraordinary Evil, A Brief History of Genocide. It's a fascinating book that deconstructs genocide going through history, continuing her lifelong examination of ethical behavior and the human condition. The book is published by Viking and retails for $30. Barbara Coloroso is on the line from here in Vancouver.
I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Barbara Coloroso. Good morning, Ms. Coloroso.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Let's talk about current events first and see how this ties into your book. Virginia Tech, the tragic events there in the recent weeks. That was the shooter, the killer, was obviously a victim of bullying, was he not?
What I referred to him as, and it's interesting, when I was asked before he was identified, who I would suspect it might be in all my work in school shootings, and I said it would be one of two kinds of kids. One is extremely rare, if never, a person who perpetrates this kind of crime, and that would be the person who, in the very narrow clinical definition of mental illness, they tend not to take out a bunch of other people. They tend to take out people they know. The other one would be the bullied bully. There are lots of different kinds of bullies, but the bullied bully is a kid who's been relentlessly tormented by his peers and doesn't strike back in rage or kill himself, commit suicide, as so many horribly tormented young people do. They instead turn that rage into utter contempt for other human beings and take out a whole lot of people before they kill themselves. And it is that latter one, I think, that we saw with the school shooting. Because immediately things came out that he was a loner, he was a loser, we teased him a lot. No, you isolated him and you taunted him a lot. And I was interested in his ramblings, because there's an element of truth in his ramblings. If we look at them as we looked at Eric and Dylan's at Columbine, and you look at Jeff Wise's in Red Lake, there are elements there where he talks about things being stuffed in his mouth, or he'd be thrown down or tormented when he didn't speak English well. And his peers have borne that out and said, yeah, some kids were horribly mean to him. Now, other people make other choices. I mean, a man who went through the Holocaust, which is hell and back again, stood in a door and took the bullet while other kids escaped. Other kids kill themselves when they've been through that kind of horror, and others take other people out.
Another question about this, it doesn't really pertain to the book, but as an educator, as someone who studies bullying and parenting and so on, was it appropriate, do you think, of the network NBC to air the writings, the rantings of this individual?
You know, I've been asked that a lot, and it's not an easy yes or no. I believe for those who actually need to have that information and have it as a valuable tool, can benefit from seeing that. Others, when you use it as entertainment or to get ratings, then I'm far more cautious, because kids are seeing it over and over and over, and whenever it's played like that, we invariably see a copycat, and children's lives are too precious to be doing that for sensation. I think elements of it, being very judicious about it, we don't put everything in its total on the news, but some being very judicious about it, and using the element, not that... as I saw it, and I saw it with Columbine, I saw it with Red Lake, I've seen it at other school shootings, Santee, California, where we say the kid is mentally ill, so we don't have to worry about it. He was just sick. How can we keep these sick people off the streets? I think we need to look at the disposition of the shooter, the situation the shooter was in, and the system that the shooter was in. Because if you ask high school kids who they're most afraid of, it is not a bully, because bullies tend to isolate very specific individuals by high school and leave the rest of the kids alone or ask them to join in the bullying. But the kids they're most afraid of is the bullied bully. The kid can't take it anymore. And so we have to take that to heart and look critically. Never would I ever say that anything any of the kids did to him caused him to do the shootings. But we need to look at the situation and say, did we contribute to pushing him over the edge? If we're going to say never again, which keeps happening again and again, just as in bullying and genocide, then we have to take stock of the situation and the system as well as the disposition of the bully or the bullied bully.
I've got another question now. What about the idea of people who see this, who are in the same situation as this individual, and see his killing, his rampage, as an excuse to do the same, like, you know, copycat killers?
Well, it's there. That element is there. Like I said, we have to look at the situation and the system that could put a kid over the edge. And perhaps giving him frontline news and top cover fold on the newspapers of him, not a picture of him as who he was, but as he fell, his final statement. That wasn't all of who he was, but that's his final statement, and a bizarre one at that. And so I have a problem with putting it out there for sensation. If you look at Schindler's List, he did a magnificent job, Spielberg did, of putting horror on film, not to titillate, not to make sensational, but to teach. And I think it can be used that way.
A lot of people who've read your book in anticipation of its coming out said that this was a departure for you. You don't see it that way.
I don't at all. I see it as a short walk. And I'll give you a bit of history. I work in Rwanda with orphans from the genocide. However, I've had a fascination, if you can call it that, with genocide since I read Elie Wiesel's Night on a plane trip in the late 70s, and well, actually the early 70s, and was stunned that I knew so little about it, having a master's degree and being in education. So I began my own personal study, and if anyone who has read Kids Are Worth It or Parenting Through Crisis or my ethics book or the bully book, you will see elements in there where I've quoted people like Viktor Frankl or Primo Levi or Simon Wiesenthal. So I began demonstrating how that truly influenced my beginning works. That study where how can ordinary people commit such extraordinary evil? And in Kids Are Worth It, I talked about raising kids who can think and act ethically, who will stand up for values against injustices by teaching them to think critically. My ethics book is to teach them to care deeply and share generously and help willingly, which I believe are the antidote to the most virulent agents ripping apart the fabric of our humanity. Number one is hating other human beings with utter contempt. So I was invited to Rwanda 1 year. I had been working there with orphans, but I was invited not only to work with the orphans, but to speak at the university to new education students who would be then going into teaching. And they wanted me to talk about my latest book, The Bully, The Bullied, and The Bystander. And I said, oh, good. I'm going to a university 11 years ago where half the staff killed the other half. That was 11 years ago during the genocide, and half the students contributed to the death of the other half of the students, and you would like me to talk about schoolyard bullying. I will do it if I can demonstrate to you that it is a short walk from schoolyard bullying to hate crime to genocide. It is not a giant leap. All three have as their foundation contempt for another human being. In a bullying situation in the schoolyard, the bully has the target in mind and in sight, but there is a third character there, the bystander. William Burroughs said there are no innocent bystanders. What were they doing there? Well, in a schoolyard bullying situation, you have the bully's henchmen. Those are the kids you didn't raise to bully, but you raised them to do the police, so they're obeying orders. Just as Eichmann said, I made those trains run on time, and I was only following orders. The active supporters that cheer the bully on, we saw this in British Columbia where 100 kids knew about the death of Renee Virk, and some of those kids cheered on the girls as they broke her arms before they drowned her. And then you have the passive supporters who get pleasure from somebody else's pain. They're not doing it, but they're getting pleasure. Then you have at the very bottom of this bully circle, a deadly lot who can include you and me as adults. And that's the disengaged onlookers who look at bullying as part of conflict or roll their eyes and say, oh, boys will be boys, girls just want to be mean, it's part of growing up. On the upswing of the circle, you have the potential witness. And that is the kid you did raise to act with integrity and civility and compassion. But they're afraid of the bully. They're afraid if they step in, they'll be next. They're afraid they'll make it worse for the target, or they're simply afraid because they don't know what else to do. Those kids all feed into the bullying and create a situation and a system that begins to take on a life of its own. So parents will say, I cannot believe my kid joined in and dunked that other kid's head in the toilet. Well, it's that system that's working with the bully and the bystanders who are attempting to humiliate the target. We see the same thing happening in a hate crime, where there's utter contempt for a group of human beings, and we make them into an it, and dehumanize them, just as we do in verbal bullying, in schoolyard bullying. When it comes to genocide, and this is where it's such a short walk, is the people are verbally bullied, physically bullied, and relationally bullied through laws and politics and a system that's in place in a government. And then the government, and that's what genocide is where it's a government or people connected with the government decide another group of people in this country don't deserve to live. And they take them out for no other reason than they're a Tutsi or a Jew or a Roma or a Sinti or an Armenian. And so that's how it connects. They're not synonymous with one another, but it is a short walk. So if we're going to say never again for genocide, we have to take a serious look at how we are teaching young people to dehumanize other human beings and get away with it. You mentioned the media. I was asked if I'm concerned about the violence kids are exposed to. I am. But I got to tell you, I'm just as concerned about the humor our kids are exposed to, where they are learning through the programs they watch to laugh at another human being's pain, which actually covers over with a lot of muck that natural and necessary must in us to relieve another human being's suffering. You look at little children, they'll hand a blanket to a baby who's crying because it's in them to care. And we're covering it over with a lot of muck.
Do you think that these ideals, this moral integrity that children should have, is that something that they're taught? Is that something that they have?
Well, the deep caring, compassion, and loving kindness we see in infants. When one baby's in distress, the other baby is in distress. By 1.5, they'll hand another baby a blanket, even though the baby needs milk. They know they can help relieve the suffering. They don't know how. At 4 years old, you give a child a cookie who's not into bribes and threats and rewards and punishments, which is a whole other thing, an insidious thing that interferes with ethical behavior. Give her a cookie, and she sees another child without a cookie, she'll break hers in half and give it to him. And we say, well, sweetheart, that was a nice thing to do. Why did you do that? And she looks at you like, you nuts lady, he's hungry. Mm-hmm. There's no tax write-off. There's no scratch and sniff sticker and star. There's no reward. There's no catch him being good. It's because he's hungry. So what we must do with children is nurture it in them. It's there, but we have to nurture it in them by caring deeply about them, showing them how to share generously and to help willingly, which, again, I think are the three antidotes to hating other human beings, hoarding, me, mine, and more, and harming other people with lying and cheating and stealing. And so if we can, in every single day, help our young people do that, we'll go a long way toward breaking this cycle. Will we stop conflict? Absolutely not. Conflict is normal and natural and necessary. Next time your kids fight, first thing I want you to say is they're normal. My job as a wise and caring adult in a conflict situation is to teach kids to handle it nonviolently, because they're going to be in conflicts all their lives. Bullying, on the other hand, is a learned behavior. You have to learn that somebody's less than you. You have to learn that it is okay to call them cockroaches and vermin and dogs or Raja cattle. You have to learn that. And they have to learn it from their society, their school, or their home. I ask parents, how do you treat hired help? How do you treat somebody who's moving in the grocery store slower than you? How do you treat somebody whose skin color is different or English is not their first language? How do you respond at a family get-together when you have a bigoted relative, because we can have bigoted relatives, tells a sexist or racist joke? Can your children see you saying, I'm bothered by that? When all the other relatives roll their eyes and say, what, can't you take a joke? And you say, not that kind. And you know you've had an impact when you walk back in the dining room and everybody shuts up. But you've also taught your children. Our ethic, our way of being in the world, is as much caught as it is taught. So you can give kids Bible studies. You can give them stories from the Quran. You can give them from Midrash and Judaism. You can give them Buddhist stories. You can give them all those stories, teaching them. But you've got to know that a big part of that is caught. What's going on in their own lives? What's helping create that or move that along so it's real to them? Do they have good, strong models, role models in their parents and the community at large?
When you visited Rwanda and you gave your talk, as you said earlier, did you find 11 years after the genocide that they realized what went wrong, where they went wrong?
Well, that was an interesting thing to me because I brought with me to lecture for the students the bully cartoons that my son had done to illustrate the bully circle. And I had to apologize to them and say, I don't have a circle with genocidaires and their henchmen and the targets in the genocide. And I apologized, but I said, I want you to understand it is a short walk, but let's use these cartoons to demonstrate it. And there was a large group of Abuka, those are survivors of the genocide, in that class. And within minutes, on that bully circle, the cartoon characters, they began to put where the UN fit, where a church, the institution of the church fit, where church leaders fit, where people in their community fit, where the United States fit, where Canada fit, where Romeo Dallaire fit. And many of them put him up there under the antithesis of the bully, the witness, the resistor, the defender. But put the UN right up there with contributing to it because they saw it as a conflict and told Romeo he had to remain neutral, impartial, and at the consent of both parties. And then they very quickly started to put where their neighbors fit and relatives fit on this bully circle. So what it demonstrated to me and so many of the survivors in the genocide of the Jews and Roma and Sinti and second generation of survivors from the Armenian genocide of the Armenians is they very quickly can relate it, take that short walk, and begin to put those same characters in place. And one of the biggest reliefs, so many of them have said to me, is it was an aha moment for me when you didn't call it a conflict. Because if you remember, the world treated Rwanda as a conflict. When the Allies went into Europe, it was not to stop Hitler from killing the Jews, or we'd have bombed the train tracks. It was to stop him from the conflict, the war. And in my book, I write about the fact that it is the guerrilla in our midst, based on a research project done in 1999, where they asked people to watch a 75-second video, and they asked some people to count all the white shirts passing a basketball to white shirts, all the black shirts passing a basketball to black shirts. And they had to count it. Very simple. In the middle of this video, a woman in a gorilla suit, came onto the screen, pounded her chest, made lots of noise, and walked off. 64% of the people watching that 75-second video did not see the gorilla. It's called inattentional blindness.
They just assumed that she was black, in black shirt, is that correct?
Well, they dismissed her. They were really? So intent on counting white shirts or black shirts. They were busy with their job. And when the UN sent in a peacekeeping troop into Rwanda, they were busy remaining neutral, impartial, and the consent of both parties, which is what you do when there's a conflict. That is not what you do when there's a genocide. And in all three of the genocides I talk about in my book, there was the midst of war, or civil war, or in the other two situations, World War I and World War II, that the gorilla was able to roam free in that mess because we missed it. Romeo, it wasn't until Oxfam said, this is a genocide, that his eyes were open and he said, oh my gosh, this is not conflict. This is not remaining impartial and neutral and the consent of both parties. And that was the first time he violated, as a good soldier, violated an order. When the UN said, we're pulling out, there's no peace to keep, he said, we can at least save 20 to 30,000 Tutsis. We've lost almost 1 million. We will stay and save those. I have to do that. How he wishes he had done it in January when a defector came and said, I want safe passage for my family and myself, but here are the lists of all of the people they intend to kill, this government intends to kill. Here are where the machetes are stashed. And Romeo wrote to his superiors at the UN that he would like permission to seize the arm caches and to deal with this. And he was told to remain neutral and partial at the consent of both parties, to the detriment of a million Tutsis.
You mentioned that being a disengaged onlooker, which is part of that bully circle, could be us. If
yes.
we read something in the newspaper and it's you know, a world away, we may not care.
And we have to care. The world's a very small place. It was disheartening to me.
How do we care, though, Barbara?
Well, it was disheartening to me to see that we didn't even call it a genocide. In fact, in my country, the government officials were told, don't use the word genocide because then we have to act. What's even more disheartening is now we've labeled Darfur a genocide, and we're twiddling our thumbs and waiting for the Sudanese to let us have permission to come in with a larger peace force. We're still seeing it as a conflict. We're still hearing it in the news that way. And what we as communities, and I saw there was a march here recently from Calgary to Edmonton to talk about doing something now. But we have to get the politicians who are listening to our voices. And we have to get the UN to say, not, oh, excuse me, do you mind if we come in and help make peace here? But no, we're coming in. As an international community, you cannot continue with impunity. Because genocide is taking out an entire group of people. This is not a conflict. That we are coming in to provide safe passage for these people and safe harbor. And we're going to be armed to the teeth, and don't you dare try to go over us. That's what we have to do. In a schoolyard, how often we as adults see it as a conflict, and we say to two girls, one girl has ostracized the other girl and gotten all her friends to go along to spread an ugly rumor, and the girl who's been targeted comes to you, and you say, well, let's sit down, let's be nice, we can work this out, and the bully's all ready to work this out and saying, sure, you know, I can do this, yeah, I spread that rumor, but I'm sorry, I didn't, if that bothered you, I'm sorry. And the target's sitting there saying, I'm not ready to make nice, you don't know what this girl's done to me. And we look at the target and say, you really have a problem with social skills. We retarget the target. We have the John Wardi in Darfur attacking with impunity villages. And they first kill the young men who could possibly defend the village, and then take out and rape the women and kill the children and butcher the old people. And when some people strike back and gather the resources to fight back, we say, ah, see, it's a conflict. See, I told you. No, it's not. It's targets trying to survive. And when we can begin, and that's one of the things I hoped when I wrote the book, knowing it would come under attack from some scholars who would say, you know, how dare you even equate the two? And I'm not equating them. I'm saying it's a short walk. But if we can open our eyes to the schoolyard bullying, how devastating that can be to another human being, then perhaps we as an international community can begin to relate to the horrific bullying that goes on the national level, in a government level, that will destroy another group of human beings simply because we can.
The notion of forgiveness, the concept of justice, is that something you go into in the book?
I do. In fact, I take on both of those, and they're not the same thing.
They're not.
No. We'll start with forgiveness here. Simon Wiesenthal, Simon Wiesenthal wrote a book called Sunflower, The Possibilities and Limits of Forgiveness. I think we've used forgiveness, it has its place, but it is not something that can be demanded, and it's not something that's a two-person act. Our children's godfather, Father Martin Lawrence Janko, was kidnapped in Lebanon in 1983 and held in the Bakaa Valley for 18 months. And when he came out, he stayed at our home to heal through some of this. And he wrote a book called Bound to Forgive. But he talked about, as Simon Wiesenthal did, the limits of forgiveness. And he said, it is for me to forgive so that I'm not bitter and that I'm not eating the silage of bitterness that will make me act in ways that are not healthy for me. His biggest concern when he was chained to a radiator was that he would lose his caring self. And when Kagame asked me, what would I require of people? Because in Rwanda, there are church groups and there are individuals saying, you must forgive. And some of these survivors are saying, my whole family was slaughtered in front of me. You made me throw my baby into a cistern. You cut my sister's baby out of her womb. You chopped my siblings in front of me. And you're asking me to forgive. I'm not there yet. And he asked me, what would I ask of those people? What I would ask of them is that they not lose their caring self, that they don't have to like everyone they have to live by, but they must honor their humanity, which the genociders did not. In that way, if you lose your own humanity in revenge and anger and bitterness, then the genociders have won. But if you can hold on to your caring self and move on in your own life with that forever a part of your tapestry, you can't ever pull that thread out, but it's there. But to be able to move on and to celebrate your own life, that's what I would ask of them. But we've got to be there to help them. They've lost everything. We've got to be there as an international community to give them schooling, to deal with orphans, to make sure they can get on with their own life with food and land. And the prisoners in Rwanda were far better taken care of than the targets for a period of time, and that has to end. And then the whole issue of justice. You can't lock them all up. Many were locked up, but you can't keep them locked up forever either. The Arusha trials dealt with the level one genociders. There were trials in Rwanda held for the level one. Those are the ones who were perpetrators and instigators and henchmen who actually did that. But there have also been trials then in the communities called Gachacha for those who participated in the looting or stood by and didn't do anything, where they have to make restitution, resolution, and reconciliation, where they have to fix what they did as best they can, figure out how they can keep it from happening again, and find a way to heal with the people they've harmed, knowing that they can ask forgiveness, but it doesn't have to be given. It's a different mindset. When Simon Wiesenthal's book was published in the late 90s, every time it's republished, they ask different people to talk about what Simon was talking about in terms of why he would not forgive a German soldier who asked his forgiveness on his deathbed for killing a bunch of Jews, but not him. And he walked out silently. He swatted his face. He took care of him. His caring self was there. But he didn't offer him forgiveness. And Simon Wiesenthal asked the powerful question, did I do the right thing? And my children's godmother, who was my novice directress, because I'm a former nun, she's also a Seneca, a First Nation person, and she said her grandmother always said that you need to go to the wise people to help you get rid of your poison, the poison that's in you when you've been harmed, so that it doesn't destroy you. So that's, I think, what we need to move more in, instead of saying, oh, let's ask forgiveness, let's be forgiven and move on. This is a horrible, the most devastating thing that can happen to a group of people is a genocide.
Finally, Barbara, you talked about adopting a different mindset. We all should. How hopeful are you that people's hearts and minds will change in this generation or the next?
I'm actually more hopeful of this generation than I am my own, because the blinders have been pulled off. The mist has been lifted with the shining some light on what bullying really is. I'm beginning to see young people, although bullying is here and cyberbullying is here, we can get very pessimistic. But I use Viktor Frankl's term, tragic optimism, that we can look at this and say, we're in a mess. Killings are going on. Genocides are happening. We're at war. We're torturing people with impunity. We're in a mess. So what can we do? And I see young people marching to Edmonton. I see young people standing up and saying no to bullying. I see those witnesses and resistors and defenders. So I am hopeful, but they've got to have it caught as much as taught. We have to be there teaching them, but we also have to create a climate in our schools and our homes and our communities where you don't ever put anyone outside your circle of moral concern. You don't ever refer to somebody as a cockroach or vermin or a dog or a snake. You don't use verbal bullying. You don't shun other human beings. Again, as I say, you don't have to like every kid in the class. You've just got to honor their humanity. And the more our children are taught to care deeply and share generously and help willingly, I believe we, as part of the human race, can evolve to a much more sensitive and caring community.
Barbara, this is a fascinating book, and we could talk forever.
I could, actually.
and rightfully so, because it is full of information, and it's thought-provoking as hell. And thanks so much for joining us today, and continued good luck with it.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to do it in depth, as you've enabled me to do it.
You're very welcome, and thank you.